mixed use use can and often do work. There's an assumption that people with sex offences can't be held in the same institutions as those with other offences, and that's absolutely not the case. Very few people I interviewed spoke about physical violence. We know that TCs tend to be on the whole physically safer. Yes, they might have experienced belittling language and other sort of behaviours that were unpleasant, but I heard nothing like physical violence, getting beaten up or threatened.
Hi, I'm Naomi Murphy, and this is the Locked Up Living podcast, where we talk with a wide range of people about harsh aspects of institutional life.
We also explore some of the ways to overcome them and to grow and develop. I'm David Jones. So join us every Wednesday morning, 6 o'clock UK time, for a fresh podcast. Today we're meeting with Anna Kutova and Geraldine Akerman, and Anna is a lecturer in criminology at Birmingham University. Her teaching and research interests are in prison sociology and the carceral impact of imprisonment on families of prisoners. She has researched the impact of long sentences on partners of prisoners in the UK, the experiences of prisoners serving sentences for sex offences in TCs, and the use of video call technology in prisons. She teaches criminological theory and punishment in a global context. And Geraldine Akerman, who we've met before, she's the first returnee of our podcast series, is a forensic psychologist who worked at HMP Grendon for many years and now works for the NHS. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you very much. Lovely to be back.
Thank you.
Good to meet you, Anna, and also really nice to have you back on, Jerry, after you were on previously. I think we both really enjoyed your paper and we're really interested to have this conversation today. I think whilst all violent offending has the potential to be very damaging, sexual offending tends to be treated as if the impact is always much worse for victims and their families. And it seems even harder to have a balanced discussion about this kind of offending than other types, with all forms of sex offending generally being lumped together. Can you tell us how you came to do this piece of research, what interested you in it, and how it came about?
So Anna and I had sort of met through the University of Birmingham, where I also do a guest lecturing, and we'd talked a lot about this, of how people who've had sexual offences committed on them and have also gone on to commit sexual offences, and how those two things can be so difficult to talk about, particularly in therapy, where we know things can be very in-depth. So thinking about how people could talk about things which are both sort of stigmatising and very shame-inducing. So that the fact that people have talked about it, we wanted to ask really what made it those people able to do that, so that we could also help then people in the future. Do you want to add to that, Anna?
Yes, I think the priority was to identify a gap, so to speak. And what was really interesting for me is, as a someone who's not a forensic psychologist, is to really unpack those social relationships, because we know that sexual offences are the most stigmatised, or one of the most stigmatised in a prison setting. So it was really interesting for me to know how is that navigated in a context where openness and transparency is almost presumed or built into the institution, when we know that it's one of the hardest things to talk about. And so that's where I came from, really. And then I sense checked it with Geraldine. And in fact, there was a gap in the literature. We applied for a small research grant and were successful. So we're very grateful to NOTA for funding this research. And yes, and the paper is the end product of that small but really important project.
Thank you. And you conducted your research within therapeutic communities, and you refer in your paper to therapeutic communities operating within three moral dimensions. Could you say what you mean by this, especially bearing in mind that some of our listeners won't be that familiar with therapeutic communities, perhaps?
Yes, so everything in society has a set of moral norms. And by moral norms, we mean here a sense of what is right and what is wrong. And sometimes they are contradictory depending on the context, sometimes they're complementary. And what we argued that in a TC you have the institutional set of rights and wrongs, right? So these are the prison rules, the rules that are set up by the institution. You also have what we call the con code, which is the moral, the unspoken, unwritten moral code of prisons. So this normally includes things like not snitching on each other. This includes also things like stigmatization of men with sexual convictions. So the moral hierarchies of offences. And then you've got societal norms, you know, norms of the outside society, the rights and wrongs. And this also stigmatizes sexual offending to a large degree, but also stigmatizes men who were victims of sexual abuse. There's a huge degree of social stigma around men who've been abused, normally with stereotypes around, you know, you're a man, you should have prevented this, you could have protected yourself. It's seen as a lack of masculinity and all of those stereotypes that are inherent. And what was really interesting is how these three moral planes, the institutional, the con code and social morality, played out in a context which was very morally laden, because TCs are all about, or they are intended to open up a moral dialogue. It's intended to be to help people talk about why they offended, the problems they faced, and how to make sure they don't offend again. And so it's a very vulnerable place. It's a very moral place, and yet morality in it is very messy. And so it was really interesting to explore that and how it shaped the relationships within TCs.
Thank you. Did you want to add anything, Geraldine, to that?
No, I think, as Anna said, it is thinking about the people in TCs are from society outside, and so they are a sort of microcosm of society outside, and so the people in them at any given time can really affect how things are, the culture, and how that can change depending on who's in the TC at the time. And so what we often find, or I think we normally always find, anybody taking part in research has a reason to do that. So often people who take part in the research have strong views about something and want those sort of views to be known. But it gives them a voice where they might not have had a voice, which we wanted to do, really. We really wanted to try and help understand this whole process within a TC.
Thank you. And in your paper, you also use the term lateral penal power, which might be particularly relevant given the context that your research was conducted in. I wondered whether one of you could explain what you mean by this.
Yeah, so by lateral power, we mean the horizontal social relationships. So these are relationships between men in TCs who are called residents rather than prisoners. So we were interested in the power relationships and power dynamics between residents, as opposed to the more frequently studied dynamics between the institutional power, which is officers, governors, civilian prison staff. And so we were really interested in this place, which is meant to be very, compared to mainstream prisons, much more democratic and much more flattened in terms of power inequalities. There's a lot more opportunities for residents to enact power over each other. And I deliberately didn't want to see power as something that's held by people, and not held by others, because I think it's very often the case that men with sex offences are spoken about in terms of having no power. Power to me is something that's negotiated. It can be claimed, it can be taken away, and it's relational. It flows between people rather than being something that is possessed by people. And so what we meant by lateral power is the inequalities between horizontal inequalities between residents with different offences. So in our study, these were men with sex offences compared to men with other types of offences.
And I think that's often one of the people who are anxious about therapeutic communities. I think that's one of the things that people are frightened about, isn't it? That lateral penal power. I wonder what safeguards are against to make sure that's not misused within therapeutic communities.
Well, I think often the staff will be very, really be aware of that and how power's shifting. As David will know, and we have annual reviews of where peers will come in and sort of see how we all are look at, against the standards of a TC. And one of the things we think about a lot is who holds the power and how is that negotiated and how is it discussed. And so again, you could have a person who's committed a sexual offence could well be in a position of power based on a number of things. It could be because of their personality, that they're a person that likes to be in that position, or it could be that people have chosen them because they think they might be easily manipulated. So there's loads of reasons. So we'd always be looking at those sorts of considerations, really, and to think about how has each individual got into a position of power, and are they, just as we would with staff, really, and are they using it or misusing it? So we do think about that, to think about how are they using power.
And it sounded like you were saying, because of the con code and the moral hierarchy in terms of offences, that people who've committed sex offences are particularly vulnerable within this lateral power organisation. Is that always the case?
I think it can often depend on the individual, because some people attribute how they get treated by others to their offence, when it might well not be that. I mean, I think that's something we saw, it came out in the research, and I've seen over many years. So people will think, oh, they look at me like this, or they treat me like this because of my offence, when often it's not that. It could be their personality, it could be lots of other reasons. So I think that's something we consider, really.
I think it's really important to also recognise that a lot of people stigmatise themselves, they internalise their status, and this isn't to diminish what people experience, of course. You know, even if it is the case that they feel they're being treated badly because of their offence, but it might be because they're just not a very nice person, which is something that did come out in the research. You know, staff would say it's very hard to know, you know, this person saying that they're not liked because of their offence, but actually they're not liked because they're not very nice. So their offence has very little to do with it. But if the person themselves feels it's because of their offence, that matters, and that's important, because that is part of their experience.
And Anna, you described stigma as being a function of power. Can you say a bit more about this and how it might affect those who've committed sex offences?
Yeah, so this stigma cannot simply be enacted against anybody. Stigma is an interactional thing. It's an interactional process. It's about social relationships. If you're in a relatively disempowered position, it's very hard for you to stigmatize others. So, for example, if I wanted to stigmatize a corporation I think is morally corrupt, I would find it very hard to do as a simple individual, simply because I don't have the power to do that. Whereas if you are in a relatively privileged position of power, whether it's you being an institution, you being higher up on the offence hierarchy than others, you find yourself in a position where you have more opportunities to reclaim power or to take power away from others. Or to, in fact, stigmatize, because stigma is about enacting power. Stigma is a process whereby you show or tell others that they are less than you. So stigma is very closely linked to power. And there is a wonderful paper by Imogen Tyler and Slater where they say it takes power to stigmatize. And that's absolutely the case. If you have comparatively little power, you simply won't be able to stigmatize somebody else, no matter how much you might want to do it.
And that can often be the case, that people with a sexual, particularly maybe people being sexually abused, might not feel able to speak up about something because of the impact that's had on them, and not being able to recognise at even a young age that they couldn't have stopped it. I've been working with people using EMDR recently, and quite a few people, that's the thing, is that they'll think they should have done something to stop it, and even as an adult they don't recognise, until we really go back to that, what it was like as a child to be able to, you know, not be able to stop that, what was happening to them. And that can really make a big difference once they can actually experience that it wasn't their fault and they couldn't have done anything. That can stop themselves stigmatising themselves and thinking, I should have done something and I haven't got any power, and then I haven't got any power now because I didn't have power then. It becomes something that goes with you through your life, really.
Thank you, Geraldine. So you mentioned that in society generally, sexual offending is deemed to be especially horrific. So I wonder if we can have a bit of a conversation about that, because you'll be aware, of course, that Freud talked about polymorphous sexuality existing within the young infant, and of that being gradually coming under the control, the command of the social norms, which of course evolved over the course of many thousands, many tens of thousands of years, along with sanctions against things like incest, for example. And he suggested that this was often associated, or became associated, with the disgust reflex. Do you think so that this kind of anger and not quite sure what word to use here, but I'll say it anyway, the kind of revulsion, whether it's a constructed revulsion or whatever, do you think this is in the same kind of area, that these large social and psychological forces come to play in relation to sexual offending?
Yeah, that's a big question. I think, you know, Freud, as we, you know, I think most people consider that he was really ahead of his time in being able to sort of consider some of these things that had never really been spoken about before. And I think sometimes people think, oh, well, that was a long time ago and things have changed. But I think he did have good ideas to begin with. But I think generally they've been built on since and looked at sort of slightly differently, and not as in the sort of extreme ways he thought about them. But I think he would often think about people who were being abused, that they were, it was a fantasy, that it hadn't actually happened. And I think we and society can sometimes think that as well, because it's almost unbearable to think it is happening. So I've often experienced in the TC where somebody will disclose they've been abused, and people were like, oh no, not again, that couldn't have happened. And they just don't want to believe it, really, because you want people to feel safe in their own home and feel safe with the people that should be caring for them. So I think, you know, I don't know if that was what was going on for Freud when he heard this, of thinking, oh, just, it's unbearable to consider that. But I think he did, you know, see deviance, as he described it, as a perversion, and that things should be how he thought they should be. And so anything that deviated from that wasn't normal, really. And he considered that women wanted men to overpower them, so that if they said no, they didn't really mean it. They really wanted, you know, wanted to be persuaded, which again is very different to how we see things now. But I think he started the conversations, and things that maybe we wouldn't have done had he not had those conversations. But he sort of considered that it was a sort of some sort of arrested development, where people became fixated at a particular stage of their development. And so, again, that's something that's still considered, I think, in some areas of what might somebody might commit a sexual offence because they're, for instance, attracted to children, which started when they were the similar age, and they just didn't develop in up to being sexually attracted to adults. And so I think there's sort of roots of ideas. You know, he's had some really good ideas to start with. I think we've probably gone on further now with biopsychosocial models. You know, so we look much more like biological, as what's happened to people, developmental models, environment, cultural influences, and you know, a lot more roundedly, really, at what makes people, what develops the sexual attractions, and what's in place for people to enact or not enact some of the things they feel sexually attracted by. Now we think about things of attachment and lack of social skills, hormonal levels at certain times in developmental phases. We think lots more, I think, roundly about why people do what they do. Links, because we think links between sexual aggression and testosterone are mixed, really. That's not a clear cut, that's not a defined route. So I think there's lots more things coming into play now, rather than simply, as Freud put it, I think now it's the ideas have come on a long way from there, really.
Thank you for that, Geraldine. I want to bring you back, though, because I wasn't wanting to get caught up with some of Freud's more worn-out ideas, but I was trying to find out what it is that drives this almost universal phenomenon, whereby people, groups of people, newspaper proprietors, politicians believe that they can persecute people who have committed sexual offences in a way that's different from most other offences. That's what I was interested in. Do you see what I mean?
Yeah. Well, I think it's often that sense of othering, really, and pushing apart and thinking that we're not like that, and so pushing certain groups of people away from us, really, rather than and trying to understand what's driving their behaviour and helping them to understand that. So I think it does feel to a lot of people to be such an abhorrent thing to do that they couldn't imagine themselves doing that, and so anybody that could do that is, you know, by their nature then abhorrent as well. So I think it's often, and the fact that when people have sexual desires that they feel will be viewed by society as negative and disgusting, in your analogy, then they will, you know, that will evoke shame and the fear of it becoming understood and talked about, so that they could then enact them. So we have. Now we're sort of starting to look at how can we help people who have these sexual interests and sexual desires that don't want to act on them, how can we help them to manage them in such a way that they don't enact them. So there's sort of initiatives in place, for instance the Aurora Project in Nottingham, where people can self-select and go and receive therapy to ask about, you know, what can I do to manage these sexual desires? Because there's a huge amount of people that have sexual interests and sexual desires they don't or won't or wouldn't dream of acting on, but they still have the desires, so it's trying to find a way of managing them.
Interesting, isn't it, when you think about that hierarchy? Because actually, if you commit the act of murder, you won't be viewed in the same way as if you've committed the act of rape, for instance, in prison. And yet rape offers the scope of you can come back from that, you can have therapy, there is some potential for growth and recovery and healing. Murder, there is nothing, you know, that's your life over. And yet we seem to, and that we're much more repulsed by sexual offences, even non-penetrative sexual offences. So there is something, I think, that really taps into something that people find very, very distasteful.
Yeah, that's true, and I've heard people say time and time again that they would rather a member of their family was murdered than raped, and it doesn't sort of make sense, but people do say that, and that's and it is that sort of fear of the disgust and the revulsion that somebody would somehow penetrate you, or physically, or you know, with an implement or something else. But yeah, that sort of fear that you're actually being invaded in that way is fearful for people.
I guess it's also exacerbated by, you know, the long-standing taboo over all things sexual as well. You know, there is something deeply personal, there's something deeply taboo about sex overall, isn't it? It's private, it's not something that it's meant to, we're not meant to talk about it, we're not meant to, expose children to it. I'm not here trying to justify those attitudes, but they very much exist, that sex is something uniquely taboo, even when it is consensual and doesn't happen in an offending context. It's still something to be hidden. And I think that's why I remember a staff member I interviewed saying, he did say in his complete defense, you know, I would never hit a woman, but I understand how you can get so angry that you would hit somebody. I cannot understand how you would ever sexually abuse a child. It's just not in the realm of possibility. But I can understand how you can commit a violent offence out of anger, for example. And that was really interesting for me because, you know, why not, you know? And I think the why not is because of that extreme revulsion, that extreme taboo over sex.
I wonder if there's something there about our, you know, our impulses, so we can all relate to kind of like being really angry, but we might, you know, we can find ways to inhibit our anger, whereas actually for most of us we don't have the impulse to want to force other people to have sex or to have sex with minors. So I wonder if there's something about the more, I want to say it's normal to want to physically harm somebody, but maybe it's easier to connect to that rage, because we all, you know, we all feel angry at some point in time. We don't all have sexual tastes which evoke revulsion.
Yeah, one of the sort of concerns with people coming out of custody with MAPA and the police and different sort of groups will discourage people with sexual convictions of spending time together, almost as if just by being with other people they will then, you know, carry on talking, and they'll want to, and those people will support your beliefs, and so you're more likely to carry on and offend again, which is not, I don't think, the same for people that have committed murder or robbery. And although generally people aren't encouraged, I think there's sort of an obsession almost with people who you know, committed sexual offences. So I support a charity that helps people when they've come out of prison to live, you know, live in an accommodation. And so in this accommodation there's about 5 people. And so before there wasn't anywhere where they could sit together as a community, and we were trying to sort of commit a community feeling for them. But when MAPA found out that we'd actually converted a room into a place where they could all sit together, they were really concerned. And even though they could have stood in the kitchen and talked to each other, the thought that we were somehow encouraging people to sit together and talk was a real concern for them. And I think there is this belief that, you know, a group of people together, you see it in where people are on discussion forums on the internet, or, you know, that people will hold up your beliefs, so you're more likely to then sustain these beliefs, and then hope, I guess the fear is you'll act on them. So I think that's part of it. And I guess that's sometimes a fear within a TC, is that if there's a group of people that are friends together and they happen to have committed sexual offences, that they're going to support each other's beliefs and then not challenge each other. Because I think the power within the TC is that sort of is quite subtle. So an example might be, if somebody, and Anna could talk more about this because she found out about it in the research, was you know, somebody going for a job, for instance. So if in a TC somebody wants to go for a particular job, they'd ask their group and the group would discuss it, and was it a good time, was this going to be a challenge for you? And then it gets taken to a community meeting, which pre-COVID would be, you know, a whole community would be 40 people. And they would have a discussion about it. And it could be quite subtle, and I've seen it numerous times, where somebody who's committed a sexual offence, even though the job they're going for might be absolutely nothing to do with it, will be asked lots more questions than somebody who's going, having, you know, committed robbery or murder or some other offence. People don't even sort of... It's almost like that people want to be really, really protective of everybody in the prison, so they might sort of ask a question. Somebody wanted to work in healthcare, oh, but aren't there females up there? And, you know, the person might not be offended against a female, but, you know, that's the sort of, we have to protect everybody from you. And that's what we often see, and it seems like, where's this all come from? And I guess as staff, we have to identify and point it out, really, as a way of protecting from it, or asking the question of, I wonder what's happening, really. Why are we responding this way to one person, not another?
Also reminds me of other conversations that sometimes happen as well, because I think, kind of like providing long-term therapy, it's inevitable that issues around, you know, sex becomes part of the counter-transference and transference, and it's kind of like, if somebody's got a history of sex offending, it's assumed that any reference to sex must automatically be deviant, when surely what we want is for people to develop healthy sexual interests, and they're only able to do that by having the opportunity to reflect on that. And yet I think sometimes we perhaps make that impossible for people.
It's the master status playing out, right? It's the intense stickiness of the label of sex offender. Once it's there, it becomes the master status. It defines everything about that person. They stop being a person, you know, somebody who feeds the fish on the wing in a TC, a friend. All they are is a sex offender. So everything is defined through that lens, including, as we found in our research, all of the interactions they have with other people. They translate everything through that lens of the master status of sex offender.
Yeah, I thought your paper covered that really nicely, actually. I thought it was a really great term, but I thought it really conveyed that very well.
Yeah. I mean, as Anna said, they stop being a father and a son and all the other things all people see them as, which is a very sad situation, really.
Okay, we ought to move on, perhaps, although I do want to say that I think the remaining issue is to do with the taboo, which Anna was mentioning. And because what that really means is that things are hidden or secreted away. And so, yeah, the male fantasies get denied, but still acted out. I mean, if you look at, you know, across the whole sort of panorama of advertising and films and the arts, you see all of these fantasies, you know, acted out. So they're all kind of there, tucked away in the human psyche. But the taboo, as it were, clamps down on them, and then it's much harder to work on them. Anyway, that's just what I think. You touch upon the phenomenon of perpetrators as victims, and I wonder if you could say a bit more about that.
Yeah, so we know that a large proportion of men who commit sex offences have histories of sexual abuse. And it's really important here to say that the research does not claim any causality. In fact, it hasn't been concretely shown that being sexually abused as a child will cause you to go on and commit sex offences. But it is definitely a notable minority in the research that there's a correlation for whatever reason. And the cause of question was not important at all for the purpose of our research. And what was more interesting is the fact that, you know, it's a fact that a lot of people in prison for convicted of sex offences have histories of sexual abuse. And what that means is, and as one resident put it, they have to walk a tightrope between these two identities, because on the one hand, they're an offender, and on the other hand, they're also a victim of the same type of offending and an intensely stigmatized form of offending at that. This isn't to say that other people are not also victims. We know that the vast majority of people in prisons have histories of trauma, physical, emotional, sexual, exclusion from school, mental health, all of the menu of problems that people in prison have. And yet what we found was that where it seemed to be especially difficult for men with sex offences to talk about their adverse histories. Even talking to me as an interviewer, they seem to feel the need to justify that they're not making excuses. They're not saying that being sexually abused caused them to offend. And in fact, none of my participants made that claim, but they were at pains to emphasise that. And in fact, some reported, you know, being challenged when they spoke about their abuses, and most of them were abused as children. And one would think, what could be more horrific than being sexually abused as a child? But I had one participant who would say, when he started talking about being sexually abused as a child, he had other residents say, but how could you have gone and done the same thing if you know how awful it is? Whereas the person making that challenge committed a violent offence and would speak about being bullied and beaten as a child. So a very similar process, right? And yet they weren't challenged. So I think the taboo aspect of sex offending also made it incredibly difficult for them to lay any claim to victimisation at all, or at least made that claim much more tenuous. Because the fact they offended seemed to overshadow the fact that they were also victims.
So there was a sort of double layer of stigmatization there.
And of course, shame as about being a man who was sexually abused. You know, it's we know that in society, men are expected to be strong and be able to protect themselves. And yet, if you are sexually abused, you carry that double stigma. So you have the stigma of being an offender and a sex offender at that, but also being a victim of sexual offending. So it's that double layer of really messy, really complex layers of stigma there.
And I suppose we know that if people view themselves in that particular way, they project that other people are going to be thinking the same way about them as well, when they're often not thinking that at all. But they often will think, yeah, that goes back to that point of whatever they look through the lens of, this is how people view me because of what's happened to me and what I've done to people.
Great. So can you tell us a little bit about the setting, the therapeutic community, what it's like to be in one, and then what it's like to be someone who's committed sexual offences in a TC?
I think I always have great admiration for people that go into a TC, because so much is expected of them, really, that they're going to go in to meet a group of people they've never met before, and going to speak about the things that are the most shameful that's happened to them and they've done to other people. So it's a big ask for anybody, really. But put on top of that the fact you're in a prison setting, and you're there 24 hours a day, it's a big ask for people. But I think a lot of people find the containment of the physicality of a prison, the walls and the fence, another container, really, so that they can feel safe enough that they're going to be there for a while, they're going to be with the same people for a while, they see other people benefiting that have been there longer, they see people that have talked about things that are really painful and recovering from doing that. And so that gives them hope that they can feel better by talking about it as well. So they would go in and spend that much time together throughout the day. After groups, they would clean together, wash, you know, do cooking together, go to education classes, you know, spend the rest of the time around each other. And so when people who go into groups outside would go to a group and then go away and not see each other in between, in fact, it would be frowned on to see each other in between. Within a TC, they have to then face, you know, might sit in a group and really pour something very painful out and talk about it, and then face those people for the rest of the day. So that can be really powerful. But what generally they find is that people will support them to do that, and feel someone will come and talk to them and offer them support, or if they see that they want time, offer them time and space to process it themselves before they offer that support. So the nature of a TC is that people would be around all of the time to offer you that sort of support. But it's not an easy process at all for people. You know, so many people will say, I've never spoken about this to anybody, you know, not my close family or anybody in my life, really. They've never opened up to the extent to which they do in a TC to anybody in their lives. And I think particularly with men it is harder, because society tells men that they shouldn't talk about their feelings and they should just toughen up, you know, hit back. If someone hits you, just hit them back and get tougher and tougher, and not be able to sort of show your emotions. And I've sat in numerous groups where a man has talked about something really painful and is crying, and the other men in the group will be just like, stop him, just can't you just stop him crying, because they can't tolerate that distress. And it's of course painful, you know, it's painful for us all to see somebody in that level of distress, but they also see that afterwards they feel better for doing that, and that it's better to get that out and process the material that's been left in them and closed up for a long time.
But you mentioned that these processes become hijacked sometimes and turned around and used in a rather punitive way against people.
Yeah, and that can be the case for people. Some people, out of sort of a misjudged fear that they're going to, say for instance, they back somebody to go and work in healthcare, and that they think that person might attack a nurse or attack somebody that works there, that they'll somehow be responsible for that. And men will often say that when, you know, they have this fear that men will, who've committed sexual offences, will go out and do it again, and somehow they'll be responsible if they don't question them to the full extent and really challenge it, more so I think than people that have committed other violent offences against people, which could be equally damaging.
So how was that managed in the TC? Were staff able to pick it up and deal with it?
Yes, I think it's first of all really important that staff do it. I don't think it was done consistently. I think, as Geraldine mentioned before, it's very hard to pick up on these nuances. And it's also very tricky because it's a social interaction, right? So a lot of staff expressed a concern that if they stood up for somebody, that would kind of shine the limelight on them and put them at a more risk of retaliation from others, perhaps, or shunning from others. They were worried that if they started were being overly protective of somebody or seen as being overly protective, that would damage the dynamic of the group and the trust that the group had in the facilitator. But on the other hand, of course, they did have to put a stop to any kind of bullying behavior. So it was really hard to do, and people are not perfect. So sometimes residents would complain that staff didn't intervene when they felt they should have intervened. One staff member, I just remember her so vividly lamenting, "We try, we try, we try." And it was a constant navigation of really complex social relationships and having to make decisions on the spot about when do you intervene, how you intervene. So it was by no means an easy thing to do. And I think that's where training and experience become really important, because people who need that training and experience to navigate these tricky situations. Mm.
And it can be, they feel at times like a reenactment of not being protected at a younger age as well. So that feeling of staff didn't protect me now and I wasn't protected when I was young. So that can be really difficult to navigate. And it is identifying and talking, pointing these sort of patterns out and working out how, what would be the most useful, because some individuals want it and some individuals don't want it. So thinking about that with each individual is what's the most beneficial for them and for the community as a whole, because it can be that community feel that we often get accused of wrapping people in cotton wool and stopping people being questioned by, you always jump into their aid and this sort of thing. So it is a really fine balance of pointing it out rather than necessarily saying that somebody's right or wrong in their questioning, just wondering with people, what causes this? Why do we respond in this way to one person, not to another?
Do you think sometimes that staff and the system aren't as quite as aware of all the dynamics as they could be? I'm just thinking about the fact, for instance, the offender personality disorder pathway organised an event which was framed as in working with people who commit sex offences is much more challenging, so let's have a day to discuss that. And I wonder if that in some way kind of like colludes with the con code and the moral hierarchy within the prison system. I just wonder, are we always aware of when that's happening? Even kind of like, thinking about questions that we might ask you beforehand, it's quite easy to fall into the line of assuming that it's harder to work with people who've committed sex offences, for instance. I just wonder about your thoughts on that.
Yeah, and I think there's certainly a lot of staff that wouldn't want to work with that client group. And it's interesting, over time in Grendon, there's actually very few TCs that take people with sexual convictions, and some TCs say they do, but actually when you look at their numbers, they actually haven't got any. And you look at wings within TCs as well, and you sort of, there becomes a culture of, they're not overtly saying we don't take people, but there just doesn't happen to be any. And so they're always full of other people, so they haven't got space for people. And then how difficult it can be to introduce one person with a sexual conviction and build up a culture of staff and residents that can tolerate listening to the material. And so it can become its own, that dynamic of, it's much harder, so we'll work with other people. But, listening to accounts of violent offences can be really disturbing as well, and somehow there's hierarchies within people that commit violent offences. So a person who's committed an armed robbery in a bank would be considered much different to somebody who committed a robbery of an elderly person in their home, or a person who killed an adult male as opposed to a person who killed a child. All those things, they've all got hierarchies, and people will do all sorts of things to avoid listening to the material and listening to those things being talked about, because they are difficult to hear. And I think this goes to the extreme, or it seemed to go to the extreme.
Thank you.
Because it sounds, or it could sound, that some of these guys you're working with might feel rather let down by staff, and that could be quite traumatising for them.
Yeah, and I think that is often that reenactment of being let down by their family or the person that should have been caring for them, and it can feel like that. And sometimes we see people almost evoking that reaction because that's what they're used to. And so whatever you do is not going to be enough to support them, that there would be one more thing that they wanted you to do to support them, and that can be difficult. And it's going to be to find out what each individual wants in terms of support, so that they're not being infantilised in some way, but they're given the support to take their power back themselves, so that they're not, you know, we're protecting them, that they're taking back their power.
Thank you. So what were the positive things that came out of your study?
I think the positive thing was that mixed UCs can and often do work. You know, there's an assumption that people with sex offences can't be held in the same institutions as those with other offences, and that's absolutely not the case. You know, very few people I interviewed spoke about physical violence. We know that TCs tend to be on the whole safer, physically safer. Yes, they might have experienced belittling language and other sort of behaviours that were unpleasant, but you know, I had about nothing like physical violence, getting beaten up or threatened, etc., etc. And the other positive was that even when this hijacking did happen, yes, it was inconsistent and imperfect, but there was a forum within which to discuss it. You know, the facilitator could say, you know, why did you use this slur? You know, what does it mean to use this slur? Why are you using it? What's behind that slur? So there's a forum with which to unpack behaviours that were non-ideal in a TC, which I think doesn't exist, or doesn't exist in any formalised way in a mainstream prison. So if someone, for example, in a group used words like nonce or rapist or something other that was quite nasty, the facilitator could say, well, could explore that. And I think that's very valuable. And I think that's it does a little bit of dismantling of stereotypes and stigma. It can't ever completely dismantle them, of course, but it's doing a little bit of that work. And I think that is very, very valuable.
Did your research point to any, offer up any suggestions about what might be done differently by the system?
I think the key thing to come out was experience and training. We know that the prison service is notorious for hemorrhaging experienced staff. And I think when dealing with a complex context like a TC, you can't overestimate the value of experience and training. And I think that it cannot be overemphasized. I think there needs to be a lot more of that, because I think a staff member who's equipped to navigate it can be an absolute asset to the rehabilitative work that TCs aim to do. I don't know if Jerry has any other thoughts on that.
No, I agree with that. And I think also giving the people a chance to voice their feelings, I think, was really positive. And to talk about things that are usually taboo and not able to be talked about. So I think that was a real value of the research, that people could say how they felt, and that could be processed and hopefully something done about it. So I think that's very powerful as well.
And to their credit, they absolutely did. You know, the fact that people were so candid and so open with myself as a complete stranger was an absolute credit to them and to the TC in some respect, that was empowered within a TC setting.
Thank you. I think TCs have quite a good record of keeping and training staff over a long period, don't they, Geraldine?
Well, generally, I think some people will come to a TC and realise fairly early on it's not for them and not stay, which is fine because it isn't for everybody. But generally, if people enjoy a TC, they will stay for a long time. And because by their nature, they are usually well supported psychologically to do that sort of work, whether you're working with sexual convictions or violent convictions, you know, the work supported with supervision and reflective practice and things that you need around you to sort of do this sort of work. Which isn't always available in other settings, really. So I think that makes a big difference, the wider institution supporting you as well.
Thank you very much. So, Just to end off, this was obviously a fairly challenging piece of research to do, particularly as you were working in the institution itself, weren't you, at the time, Geraldine? How did you do it? How did you manage those kind of complex dynamics and complex interactions, and how did you support yourselves during the time?
Well, I think we did it through Anna coming in as a sort of an outside person, really. I facilitated it in that I would, you know, explain the research. Anna came into the TCs and spoke about it, and then I was a sort of a conduit or a person who could contact Anna should that be needed. But I think as Anna was an external person, she could see things, you know, men might talk to her differently to how they talk to me. So she collected the data, and then we both analysed it separately, and then came back together again to think about some of the themes that had come out. But, you know, there were common themes that were coming out of the data, really. But it's always, we were lucky to be, as Anna's said, being, she was supported her time and travel was supported by NOTA, so that was helpful to be able to do that. And that really helped. And I guess it was just giving people, yeah, the space and the time to think about it.
Yeah, it was definitely very, very important ethically that people didn't feel compromised, and therefore it would have been ethically completely inappropriate for Geri to interview residents and colleagues. So there was complete anonymity vis-a-vis the participants and Geraldine. And that was very important for the integrity of the research, that they felt they were able to speak to somebody without compromising either their time in prison or their jobs, because often they, you know, I wanted people to feel safe to be critical should they wish to be so. And a lot of the residents I interviewed had some critiques of the TC and expressed them, and I was very, very happy they felt safe enough to do that to me. Obviously, it was very important that I anonymized things very carefully. So getting rid of any identifiers, not just the obvious ones like names, but also the wings people were on and how much time they spent in the TC. So everything was stripped when I was transcribing the interviews. Yes, it was tricky, but it was also really interesting. And I'm very fortunate that I'm a fairly resilient person. And it, although the subject matter was quite difficult to hear, I was fortunate enough that these things tend to not affect me too much. Although I do remember Geraldine cornering me in a corridor once, going, "Are you okay?" and having to reassure her that I was absolutely fine.
Well, I suppose, Anna, we're interested in what makes you be okay with it, given, you know, it's a piece of work that we know that lots of people wouldn't be interested or wouldn't be willing to do. So there's something about you that makes it possible to do that work. And I suppose saying I'm resilient feels a little bit dismissive of your, you know, what, how do you cope with that kind of material? What gives you a strong enough stomach to be able to do that work?
I guess I'm basically unflappable anyway. I'm very difficult to shock by whatever, you know, whatever it is. I don't find horror movies scary and anything like that. I guess it's also, on a more serious note, just seeing people. These were people I was talking to, people who've done something very bad, but they were people. And we connected, we would chat about movies and books. And so, and that really helped to see the person and to realize, you know, I've spoken to lots of people in prison, and you just realize that they are people. They're not some kind of horror movie monster who will come in and devour you and, you know, be a threat to you. They were just people that you could sit down and talk to. Yes, there was obviously security measures I had to be aware of in case I did feel at risk. I was fortunate enough that I never did feel that. Everyone was always very appropriate and so on and so forth. And I'd had the training, which the prison very kindly gave me beforehand. But yeah, just realizing, I think that the overwhelming emotion I felt was sadness rather than disgust or anger. It was just sadness that these people's and their victims' lives were to put it mildly, not great. Not only did they themselves experience abuse, but they also created victims in a particularly horrible way. And that's just a whole load of sadness. And you've got to realize, and I think once you realize that, once you see humanity, it becomes very easy to then not feel anything stronger or more, not to feel revulsion or disgust or hatred or anything that would cause maybe more mental trauma. I did have to have a lot of ice cream and Disney movies during fieldwork, but that was basically it. That was my self-care.
I remember one of the times I met with Anna, I think it was before she did this research, she'd been up all night watching the Lord of the Rings films. He queued up, didn't you, to stay over, watch it overnight, watching the whole lot of them in a cinema, and then makes a long journey down from Birmingham to do her research.
Not the wisest decision I've ever made.
Okay, thanks very much indeed. I think we're going to stop there. It's been great having you on.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thanks for inviting me.
Really enjoyed that conversation. Thank you very much for coming on and discussing something that's very difficult to talk about.
You're very welcome, and the paper is free access, so I guess you'll put a link in the show notes so people can access that, and would really value your views on it and, you know, how we can take the research forward.
Great, thanks very much.
Thank you.